In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Listen to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. You must do or do not. There is no try.
All right, D, you ready to do second part of Indiana Jones' Last Crusade versus Lethal Weapon 2?
Okay, yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
All right, ready? One, two.
Oh, wait. Are we going on three, or is it like one, two, three, and then go?
Like one, two, like three.
Yeah.
I don't know. Or whatever you say, Coachies. Let's do this. Let's
on three. Okay, so it's like one, two, and then we go.
Yes.
It's a three.
That's
we go.
Right. Yes.
Okay, all right. Okay. One, two, three. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. We are over here having just too much fun for the sun. I don't know, man. This is so great to go back to 1989 and live like I'm a little 14-year-old kid again with Riggs and Indy, and just living these movies is awesome.
I know. The summer of 1989 was so special, and I want to tell you something about the summer of 1989.
Yeah.
Did you ever get Entertainment Weekly magazine?
Yeah. Oh, heck yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All the time.
So they used to come out with a summer movie preview, and I couldn't wait to get my hands on that because you could plan out, you know, what you were going to see that summer. Listen to the movies that came out that summer that are just sequels. Okay.
Okay. I need to preface. I'm gonna tease up an old episode that we did here, but I mean, like, guys, we've had an episode that was what was the best year in the 80s for movies, and the man sitting across the table from me picked 1989.
Heck yeah, I did.
All right. Well, so here's some backing on his decision on why he's picking 89 as the best year in the 80s for movies.
So you gotta clear your mind of how good these movies actually turned out to be, and just go back to like May 1st, 1989, when you got your hands on that Entertainment Weekly magazine.
Yeah.
This is what was coming down the pipe at you, okay?
Yeah.
So earlier that spring, we already had The Fly Part 2, we had Fletch Lives, we had Police Academy 6. I mean, come on.
I love how you started with, well, now you got to keep in mind, not how they finished, but how excited we were for
how excited we were.
Fly when,
that's
two.
Right. Okay.
Eric Stoltz's finest work.
Hey, listen, he got fired from Back to the Future 2, but he rebounded with The Fly 2. Okay. That summer, you had Fright Night Part 2, which we talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Menendez brothers' murders.
It was a crazy, this weird. Yeah.
It caused it to go in the tape because there's no promotions because they killed their dad who was in charge of promotions.
Yeah. The guy who was going to be the big producer was like, yes, we're going to do this. And then they waited and waited and like, why isn't this guy calling us back? Oh, because his children killed him.
What?
Ow. Yeah. All okay. right, sorry, I'm bombing your 89
that's
thing.
Okay.
Let's do it again.
No. Friday Night Part 2, you have Indy 3 that summer, which of course we're going to talk about today. You have Star Trek Part 5. Hey, it didn't turn out to be great, but you had a Star Trek movie coming at you that summer.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters Part 2, are you kidding me? We were excited to see that.
Yeah, we were. We were
right?
Yeah.
Karate Kid Part 3.
Yep.
You had Lethal Weapon 2, which I was freaking fired up for. You had License to Kill, another James Bond movie that summer.
Yeah.
You have Friday the 13th, Part 8, which we love those movies. You have Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 5. And, of course, later on that year, you get Halloween, Part 5, Back to the Future, Part 2. Are you kidding me?
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And Christmas Vacation.
Oh, well, there you go. There you
just
go.
Just sequels.
You could have led with that.
Well, I mean, just fun movies that they were throwing at us just because they knew we loved that. Now listen to this, the top three movies from 1989.
Yeah, because all you did was cover sequels, and man, there were a lot.
They were a lot.
Ton
right?
of them.
I think 17 or 18 of them.
That's crazy.
I
wonder if that's a record.
I didn't even talk about Toxic Avenger Part 2, right? Okay, so the top three movies in the U.S. for that year, 1989, you had Batman.
Obviously.
Which, that was the summer of the Bat.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yep.
And Lethal Weapon 2.
Yeah.
It's an incredible summer.
It is. It is indeed. Don't forget UHF.
UHF came out that summer.
Right.
And Dead Poets Society. I mean, it was full of great movies.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
right?
I mean, those two movies belong together in any double feature.
Dead Poets Society, UHF. Hey, real quick, before we get started in our episode, we have to give a shout out to our new Patreon member, Mr. Grant Leobroton.
Executive producer, Grant Leobroton.
Grant, thank you so much. We truly, truly appreciate you becoming a Patreon member and just supporting what we do here at the Shirley Podcast.
Guys, if you want to be an executive producer like Grant, go over to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/Shirley Podcast. You can sign up for free and see what the episodes are that we're doing because they're some of our best, but they're only for our Patreon members. And all it takes to become a Patreon member, $5 a month. Okay, Jason, so you remember last episode when we first, part one of these two episodes, we were talking about the history of the Grail, and we found out that diplomatic immunity is actually several hundred years, well over 1,000 years older concept than the Grail is. But I said that it first appeared in stories written by Chrétien de Troyes,
right,
which is a French guy, right?
Sure.
And so the name of the story that he wrote, and I have to tip my hat here, Melissa Mingle, friend of the podcast, Patreon of the podcast. I was like, she knows French. And so I was like, can you tell me how to pronounce this, please? And so the name of the story was Percival ou le Comte du Graal.
Nice.
I practiced really hard to get that.
I heard you.
Right. But so Grail is G-R-A-A-L in the French spelling. Okay.
Sure.
Okay, so just know that as I tell the rest of this story. Okay, so the Knights Templar are a huge part of the indie story, right? We didn't really talk about them that much, and I'm not going to go into them, but they're kind of a secret society like the Freemasons. So what I am going to tell you about is this guy.
Wait a minute, no, they're a real society?
Yeah, the Knights Templar are real.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, heck yeah.
They protect the Grail?
That's the rumor.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so there was a guy, his father left Portugal to escape being a part of the priesthood. And so he went to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. This was back in the 1800s.
Okay.
And his dad made quite a bit of money. And this guy's name was Antonio Augusto Carvalho Monteiro. I'm just going to call him Carvalho Monteiro, all right?
Sure.
And so after he had inherited his father's fortune, he made it exponentially bigger because he was brilliant. He spoke like 5 different languages, was a Freemason, was a bibliophile, he got his law degree from the University of Columbia. It was part of scientific societies. I mean, this guy was as educated a guy as you can get, but he was also into the occult. It kind of reminds me of a much smarter Walter Donovan.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
So I know that he must have had his Grail diary. So ultimately what happens is he goes back to Portugal. And when he's there, he buys this old castle that is called the Quinta de Regularia. And you can still go there today. I showed you a picture before we started the podcast. It's a big, ornate, beautiful castle in Portugal. Now, what's interesting, though, is not the top part of the castle, but this pit that they have. And basically, it's like a well. It's like an inverted steeple.
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
And so he bought this place. This well is called the Initiation Well because one of the prior owners of this castle, before he got it in 1892, several hundred years before, it had been owned by the Knights Templar. And it's believed that the initiation well is where they would go down and do their rituals like the Freemasons do and stuff like that. So the interesting thing is that as you go down, I mean, and it goes down several hundred feet, like it's very deep, right?
Okay. All right.
In addition to that, there are all these rooms that kind of shoot off to the side that are not really rooms. They're like caves that, I mean, they spiral through the mountain that this castle is next to for over 5 miles. It's like a network of tunnels into the mountains, and some of them go underneath cathedrals. I mean, it is crazy, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's also a whole lot of Grail symbolism at this place, including this, the first king of Portugal. Right? So this is hundreds of years before. First king of Portugal has a seal. You ready for this?
Yeah.
This is so great. So think about the word Portugal, all right? And it's in Portuguese, so it's not going to be exactly, but we've got a P, a U, an R, a T, a G, an A, and an L all in there, right? That, and there, it is a circle with these letters almost like they're going in a clock, but kind of pit-pat out of order, right?
Okay.
If you take these letters and rearrange them, you could get Portugal, but you also could get Portugal, which means through you, the Grail.
Whoa.
And so it is believed that the Grail, if there is a real Grail, very likely could be in this castle, in one of the tunnels or something like that. And that is what Carvalho Montero was looking for.
That is a great story.
Yeah.
That is a great. I wasn't sure where we're going, but that was that finished up great. Good job.
Oh, thanks.
Excellent. All right. We're going to switch back over to Indiana Jones 3. Talk about the cast.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so number one, you've got Harrison Ford.
Archaeology is the search for fact, not truth.
Other than Mel Gibson, maybe the biggest movie star in the world at this time in 1989. I can't think of anybody bigger.
Sure.
This is his third Indiana Jones movie. He's 46 at the time he does this. And he is a stud. And
he's killing it.
Awesome.
He is. I mean, you just think of if you watch the behind the scenes on this, he's riding that freaking horse.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he is riding it all over the place, and it's full throttle riding that horse. As a matter of fact, his hat kept coming off. Like, that was the biggest problem, was they couldn't keep the hat on his head because he was going so fast on these horses. That's 2 years younger than I am right now, and I got to tell you, I wouldn't be doing that crap with a horse. I would not be running around flying off of stuff and having caught on the side of a tank that they just made out of plastic and chewing gum the day before.
Right.
What?
Right.
It's crazy.
To quote Billy Crystal in City Slickers, my ass hurts just looking at that. You also have Sean freaking Connery as Dr. Henry Jones Sr.
You call this archaeology?
Yeah. I mean, when they decide that the storyline is going to be the reunion or the father and son relationship, right? That's the key ingredient. They're like, who do we get to play the father? The very first thing that Spielberg says, you just think back to that day on the beach, the sandcastle. Indiana Jones's father has to be James Bond, and it has to be the first James Bond, and it has to be the best James Bond. It has to be Sean Connery. And so fortunately, Sean Connery read the script, and he liked it.
He was delighted.
I find that if I just sit down and think... The solution presents itself.
He, however, is a guy, he's an actor who will look at a script and he will add. He will take, and it is like a study for him where he will go in and he will say, okay, this character is missing certain aspects. We need to develop these aspects. And he brought that to the table. Like, he changed who Henry Jones was. He said the character was a little flat before he got involved. But then he gets involved, brings ideas. I think he was supposed to be more like Calvinist originally. And obviously, he falls more on the Catholic side of things once we get our final picture here. But he brings these ideas to the table. They take that to Jeffrey Boehm. And that is how we get Henry Jones Sr.
Gosh. You know, they tried to get him back for Crystal Skull. And he wouldn't come back because he read the script. He's like, guys, this is not any good. I'm not coming back.
Once again, he was right.
Yeah. Now, he had an aversion to big name franchises because of his Bond experience, right?
Sure,
he did not want to get buried in paparazzi and all that crap again. Sean Connery experiences kind of a resurgence during this time.
Yeah.
So he does play James Bond again in Never Say Never Again, like you said, in 83. He wins the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for The Untouchables. Great movie. Great character. He does In the Name of the Rose in 86. He does Highlander in 86. We've talked about that. And then he goes on. He does The Presidio in 88. He does Indiana Jones in 1989. And then he does Hunt for October. He's doing Rising Sun, First Night, The Rock. I mean, he goes on to all these great movies in the 90s where he is just like...
Highlander 2.
But he experiences a total career resurgence from The Untouchables. But, you know, he was only 58 at the time he filmed this.
So he's only 12 years older than Harrison
12
Ford.
12 years older than Harrison Ford. And it was his idea that Henry Jones Sr. and Indiana Jones had slept with the same woman. That was his contribution.
Right. That's right. Yes. And it's believable.
Yes.
Which is, again, funny because she's 23. Yeah, she's 23 years old. And now she's playing an older person because she's a doctor, and you're just not going to probably be a female doctor, PhD kind of person in the 30s at that age. But
Still.
Was Sean Connery ever not bettable? I don't think so. I don't think so.
Well, let's talk about Allison Duty real quick.
Okay.
I never expected to see you again.
I'm like a bad penny. I always turn up.
So she was 21, 22, 23 at the time this movie was made. Her character was supposed to be 29, Dr. Elsa Schneider. Mm-hmm. Dr. Elsa Schneider.
Yes.
I don't know if you know this or not. She is the youngest Bond girl to date.
Really?
She was a Bond girl in A View to a Kill. She was 18 years old.
Connection. Nice.
There you go. So, Roger Moore, Bond movie, but still.
Yeah.
Bond girl. She doesn't do a whole lot after this. She's Irish, playing Austrian.
Yeah.
You buy that Austrian accent?
I 100% do, yeah. She talked about being surprised that she got picked at all, of course. And then it's a significant amount of time between the time that you get picked to do something and the time that filming actually starts. And so she worked really hard on her accent. But heck yeah, I buy it.
I do too. I think it's great.
I mean,
this is how we say goodbye in Austria. And this is how we say goodbye in Germany.
Yeah, she could have talked like Jar Jar Binks, and I would have said it was a great, great job.
Let's talk about River Phoenix for a second.
Yeah.
When I crossed an important artifact, it belongs in a museum.
River Phoenix was almost 18 years old when he plays the part of Indiana Jones Young.
Right. Henry Jones Jr.
Junior? Don't call me that. That sequence at the beginning is so awesome.
Yeah.
You actually get to see Indiana Jones being made, being forged in that scene.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay. So number one, he's probably stealing his first artifact. So that's a major life moment.
It belongs in a museum.
Right. Number two, at that time, at that moment, the other kid, the heavy kid that he's with is scared and he's like, it's just a snake, and he throws it away like it's no big deal, right? So you're like, oh, that's a different, okay. Well, he ends up on that train. And so he's stolen his first artifact. Then he falls in the pit of snakes where he's completely covered in the pit of snakes. So there's life point number two. Now he has a fear of snakes. Then he ends up in the lion's car.
Yep.
So what does he do? He runs to the wall and finds the bullwhip. And we can tell this is his first time to ever use a bullwhip, but there's life event number three. Then when he uses the bullwhip, he cracks it and it gives him the scar underneath his chin, which is a scar Harrison Ford actually has. And then once he finally, I mean, you can tell that the main guy, leader of the guys who are getting Coronado's cross, is very much an Indiana Jones looking guy. And at the end of that whole sequence, what happens is he gives him his hat. So in one maybe hour and a half period, he has developed 5 to 6 major Indiana Jones. It's quite a day.
Oh, man.
It's quite a day.
It's so great, right?
Yeah.
I mean, watching it on the big screen, I was dazzled by these life-changing events happening in front of my eyes. And I'm like, you know, it's the Leonardo DiCaprio point at the screen. Hey, that's the scar that Harrison Ford has. Oh, my gosh, that guy's got a hat. Now, you know.
Yep.
Now, I did read that the original idea for that character, they call him Fedora. Like, he doesn't have a name.
You lost today, kid. But it doesn't mean you have to like it.
That was supposed to be Abner Ravenwood at one point.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
because for those who are not as nerdy as we are, Abner Ravenwood was Marion's father, who Indiana had worked with 10 years earlier from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's it. His mentor. So that opening scene is just so good.
By the way, did you see the name of the ship?
What was it?
The Coronado.
Oh, yes.
Subtle.
Love it.
Subtle.
By the way, the Jones family house is a bed and breakfast that you can actually stay in. I think it's in Alamosa, Colorado.
We got to buy tickets.
Let's go. Go there, man. Yeah.
Oh, dude, that is awesome.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Denham Elliott for a second.
I'm so glad he's back, and I'm so glad that they really fleshed out his character on this one.
He's funny.
He is great.
Yeah.
He is great. Oh, but I have a complaint to lodge against, no surprise, Disney. So my subscription to Disney has commercials now. It didn't used to, but they changed the plan on me, and it has commercials now, right? So you know the scene where they find out that Brody is the one that has the diary, right? And he's like,
does anyone around here speak English?
Yeah. So the scene before that is Indy saying he speaks seven languages. He knows every custom in every village in 100 different countries. He will blend in. He will disappear. You will never find him, right?
Right, right.
And then the hilarity is cut to
right.
Brody walking around with feathers on his face. And does anyone speak English here? Can you help me find where I'm going? And he's obviously completely friggin' Disney sticks a commercial right at the point that it's like, he will disappear. Click commercial. I'm like, you interrupted the joke? What is wrong with you?
Well, it's Disney. That's what's wrong with them.
Yeah. My daughter was like, Dad, it's okay. I'm like, it's not okay.
It's not okay.
And so she's like, do you want to just rewind it so I can see how the joke goes? And I rewind it and she's like, oh, I don't get it. I'm like, oh, you would have gotten it had we gotten it on the first go round.
By the way, he passed away from AIDS-related tuberculosis. I did not know that.
Either.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about John Rhys-Davies for a second.
Oh, man. I love him.
Sala.
Yeah. He's so good. And he comes back. He's just as full. He is exactly the same as Raiders, which is perfect.
He adds some levity. He's a friend, you know?
I said no camels. You have six camels.
Can't you count?
Yeah. This is to make up for my brother-in-law's car.
Though that one scene when he finds Brody, he actually finds Brody on the street.
Yeah.
And he's run. Like, look here. This is a brand new newspaper. Run. Like, did you say run? Yeah. It's a great scene.
Yes.
I want to talk about Julian Glover for a second.
Okay.
He's the guy who plays Walter Donovan.
Yeah. Great.
He's British, plays great American.
Role. Yeah.
For you Star Wars nerds, he plays General Veers in The Empire Strikes Back.
He's like the pilot of one of the AT-ATs that in Empire, right?
He's the one who targets the power generator. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
He's also, get this, the main bad guy in a James Bond movie.
Really?
He plays Christatos in For Your Eyes Only.
Oh, okay.
So another Bond connection there.
Nice, nice.
No Sean Connery, but still, Bond.
And if I remember right, the guy who plays Hitler is also in Star Wars.
And he's in Empire Strikes Back. He's the guy who gets choked out by Darth Vader.
That's right, over the screen.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, he's as clumsy as he is stupid.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
Yep, a lot of Star Wars connections there. So Michael Byrne is the guy who plays Ernst Vogel, the brutal SS colonel.
Right.
This is how we say goodbye in Germany.
Yeah, I prefer Austrian.
Here's the interesting thing about him. He and Harrison Ford were in a movie in the 70s called Force 10 from Navarone, which our buddies over at the Film Eye podcast did a podcast on.
Nice.
Great sort of war movie. It's the sequel to The Guns of Navarone.
Right.
And Harrison Ford plays an American. He plays a German. No surprise there.
Talking about him, I just have to mention something. As I rewatched it this time, there were a few points in the movie that I was like, really, guys? We're really stretching the reality this far. When Harrison Ford, they're on the Zeppelin, right? And he's walking around pulling people's papers down so that he can see them. And Harrison Ford has knocked out the ticket clerk and taken his hat and his coat, right? And is asking people for tickets now. And he pulls down the paper in front of Henry Jones Sr. and their eyes meet. And he's like, Harrison Ford, Indiana comes over and he's like, ticket, sir. And he turns around and he knocks him out and then he throws him out of the plane, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, no ticket.
Right.
And everybody grabs their tickets, right?
Yeah.
That's all great.
Yeah.
100% gold.
Yeah.
He's thrown into this big pile of suitcases.
Luggage, yeah.
Which you would think would probably be going on the plane. But maybe 6.5 seconds later, the Zeppelin has launched.
Right.
And is, well, it's at least 300 feet in the air, and he's waving his fist angrily. I'm like, well, how did that just happen so fast? And why didn't they take their luggage with them? But that's it. That's just one of the small moments that I was like, well, guys,
luggage pile in
here. Right. Yeah.
Okay, D, I've got a credible nugget that I want to share with you on the cast of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, as we know, during the filming of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, River Phoenix plays young Indiana Jones. We know, of course, tragically, that River Phoenix passed away at the Viper Room in Los Angeles on Halloween 1993. Oddly enough, Sean Connery also passes away on Halloween.
Oh, whoa.
Except it's 2020.
That's right. Holy cow.
Which means, despite their vast age difference in the movie,
yeah,
Sean Connery outlived him by an extra 27 years.
Wow. Wow.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah. Two incredible guys. Okay. That's awesome. All right. Are we ready to jump into some tidbits, some fun facts, the production?
Yeah. Hit me.
Of,
what you got?
Of Lethal Weapon.
Nailed them both.
Okay, so as we talked in our first episode, the character of Leo Getz is partially inspired by Joel Silver. And as I mentioned, Joel Silver was also the producer of...
Die Hard.
You got it. In the scene where they very first meet Leo Getz, the guy comes in with the room service, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they go fly it out the window, like, oh! And they go fly it out the window into the pool.
Great scene.
As the waiter comes up out of the pool, if you look in the background, you can see the Nakatomi Plaza. Did I just blow your freaking mind?
Hey!
Yes. Yes.
Oh, that is fantastic.
Yeah.
I got to go watch that now. You have Die Hard and Lethal Weapon on screen at the same time.
In the same movie. Yep.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. You know, let's talk about that scene for a second because, you know, we talked about how when Jeffrey Boehm wrote the script for Lethal Weapon 2, he wrote a funny version and an action version, and Dick Donner told him, combine them, make it both, right? Yeah. So that scene, when Riggs and Murtaugh show up, you have a funny introduction of Leo Getz, and then they bring in the room service guy, and you jump from funny scene, intro Leo Getz, to he pulls a gun out, Riggs jumps across the table, tackles both of them, they go out a window and fall 10 stories.
Seven floors up.
I guess so, that's right.
You didn't follow me out the window, seven floors up.
And he's punching him in the swimming pool, but you have this fantastic, like, overhead POV of them dropping into the pool. By the way, I have a version of Lethal Weapon 2. Doesn't say it's a special edition, none of that, but I'm watching it and I'm like, I have never seen that scene before. Well, it turns out that it threw in a couple of additional scenes.
Okay.
When Riggs and Murtaugh enter the hotel that they're going upstairs to meet Leo, there's a hot tub with three lovely ladies.
Oh.
And Murtaugh has to tear Riggs away from him getting into this hot tub. And I'm watching it going, I have never seen this before in my life.
I have not seen that scene at all. Yeah. Oh, so, nice.
Kind of fun.
That's great. Okay, so the one kind of sad and emotional, I mean, obviously you've got Riggs is mad because he's found out that Adolf has killed not only his wife, but his brand new love interest, right? That's an emotional scene and tough, right?
Yes.
But there's another earlier emotional scene that kind of sets that all up when Riggs is in the kitchen talking to Murtaugh's wife. She's found the gold pin, right?
Yeah.
And he gives her the whole story behind the gold pin and how that's related to the death of his wife. Okay, so sad part of the movie. So as you're kind of empathizing, you probably don't realize what Riggs is doing.
He's making chili.
You know what he's doing to the chili?
Is he adding Oreos?
He is adding Oreos to the chili.
Oh, I've never noticed that before.
Yes.
What?
You want your chili with Oreos?
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy. Hey,
and I actually want to try chili with Oreos now. I'm like, wait a minute. That might work. Like, I've heard of people putting chocolate in chili before. Maybe Oreos actually would work.
Hey, if we ever have a Shirley get together, we need to have chili with Oreos. Hey, I do want to talk about the scene you mentioned before. First of all, let's back up. You have all types of things that are set up and paid off that work beautifully. At the beginning, Riggs takes a bet that he can get out of a straitjacket. He's got 5 minutes to get out of the straitjacket, and there's a guy who worked at psych ward. He's like, Riggs, I worked at psych ward. You'll never get out of this thing. And he says, oh, yeah, well, watch this. And he separates his own shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows him the flexibility to get out of the straitjacket.
Mm-hmm.
And then he, of course, has to put it back in. And it's a setup that pays off later, but it's a funny setup. And it's like, this is like a screenwriting class.
Why do you do this to yourself? Who else am I going to do it to?
Right. It's so enjoyable. Yeah. You don't realize that they're dropping obvious hints for later down.
It's Chekhov's gun. It's like if there's a gun on the wall in Act 1, somebody better be getting shot by Act 3.
Right. So later on in the movie, and here's the other thing. So later on in the movie, Vorsted, which he calls Adolf,
mm-hmm.
It's the bad guy. It's the main henchman. He's talking to him, and he says, hey, you know, we put a hit out, and you got too close to us a couple years back. We put a hit out on you, and I forced your car off the road, went down. Mm-hmm. That was your wife, right?
Yeah.
So you have a payoff from Lethal Weapon 1.
Yeah.
That's set up way back then, 2 years prior when Lethal Weapon 1 came out. You finally find out who killed Vicki Riggs. And Martin Riggs is like, had just healed from this, and now it's open wounds again. And not only that, they throw him in the water, and there's his brand new girlfriend, and she's dead. You talk about shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And angry.
Yeah.
Whew.
This was a great sequel. I mean, so I realize I'm getting ahead of this a little bit, but this made more money than the first movie did.
Sure.
Like the first movie was a huge success. $15 million budget made like $120 million. This one made even more money. It's the most successful movie of the franchise, actually.
Yeah.
But something that they had in this movie that they didn't have in the original Lethal Weapon was Mel Gibson's gun. He had a different gun in this movie. Okay. In this one, he had a Beretta 92FS and he used it again, Lethal Weapon 3. He used it again, Lethal Weapon 4. Blow your mind again.
I know where you're going. I got it.
Do you have your season's greetings tape with you?
Oh my gosh. This is John McClane's gun from Die Hard.
He is using John McClane's gun from Die Hard.
That is like the holy grail of action movie making in the 80s.
Yep.
Wow.
Not just Die Hard, Die Hard 2 and Die Hard with a Vengeance. So literally, they're trading the gun back and forth to each other. I kind of wish there was a moment where like their guns get mixed up somewhere in one of the movies.
Hey, I was talking to Jeff Johnson.
Yeah.
He and I both kind of enjoy this kind of idea of movie mashups. You could easily have Sergeant Al Powell working at the same police station as Riggs and Murtaugh. Wouldn't it have been cool if they'd worked in Reginald Val Johnson? Just even if he just walked by the screen, you're like, Al Powell!
Just a nod.
Yeah.
Just a what's up nod. Yep.
How cool would that have been?
Yeah.
Okay. There's another scene I got to talk to you about from Lethal Weapon 2.
Yep.
I mean, both of these movies are full of classic movie moments. But when Murtaugh goes, everybody's out of town. He pulls out his favorite fishing magazine and he starts his, you know, day off with
who? His morning constitutional.
His library. Yeah. His moment alone. And he sits on the toilet and he realizes when he looks over the toilet roll, it's been written, boom, you're dead.
Yep.
Which that's not very, you know, smart if you're a hitman to alert the person that, you know, you're putting a hit on them. So he goes missing. They send Riggs over to look and Riggs busts in. Of course, Leo gets his run around the house like, you know, Wile E. Coyote. And they realize that there's a bomb attached to this toilet. And you have this great scene between Riggs and Murtaugh where it's emotional, number one, and he does it all kind of with his facial features. And he's like, hey, man, and Riggs is like, I know. It's unspoken, I love you, right?
Yep.
And thank you, essentially. And Riggs is like, hey, I'm here with you. I'm going to stand with you. We're going to do this. I'm not going anywhere. You have this great scene where he pulls him in the bathtub. They pull the curtain down and kaboom, the toilet blows up. It's just a great, funny scene, you know?
It's a great funny scene, but you're right. It's an emotional scene. Like it, at no point are they more vulnerable and more connected. Like,
absolutely.
I'm going to die on the toilet. Guys like you don't die on the toilet.
Yeah.
Like, and it's, you're right. He doesn't say words. He just expresses it visually. And it is the way that we see that they could not be closer than any other two human beings. When he's trying to tell him, get out of here, Riggs. And Riggs just looks at him and then looks back at Murtaugh and is not like, it's just not even a question.
Right. I'm not going. Yeah.
So yeah, it tells you how close they are.
Yeah. It's fantastic. The chemistry is so on point. And right before that moment, you have a really great laugh out loud moment where Riggs is like, man, I got to get the bomb squad in here. I got to call all these people. And he's like, hey man, give me a break. I'm on the toilet. You know? And he's like, oh, no problem. I'll keep it low key. And then the next scene is like, fire trucks and sirens of people running everywhere. It's so funny, but it is, you have an emotionally charged moment there.
Yeah. Okay. So Riggs's place is just the nastiest place in the world. Okay.
No, it's right? not.
It's so disgusting.
Joe Pesci cleaned it up for him.
Right. Well, okay. So that's what I'm going to talk to you about.
Okay.
So there's that scene where Joe Pesci he's cleaning up, like he's cleaning up Riggs's place. And it looks like he moves it from looking like a college dorm to looking like a bed and breakfast.
Yeah,
right?
He does. I mean,
it's amazing what he's done with a vacuum cleaner. Right? But when you come in on that scene, all right, Leo is singing a song. Did you notice what the song was?
No.
The song is called I'm Not Scared.
Is this the Patsy Kensit song?
This is from the short-lived British pop group Eighth Wonder with lead singer Patsy Kensit. You got it.
Yes, that is fantastic. Okay, another payoff that comes down the road. It's just a minor thing.
Mm-hmm.
when Riggs is changing TV channels and he comes to the Three Stooges.
Three Stooges, right. Because it is from the extended version of Lethal Weapon 1, because I don't think that scene was in the theatrical cut. But you see him in the extended cut. He picks up a prostitute.
That's right.
And all of a sudden you're like, oh, this guy may be not the good guy that I think he is.
Right.
And the reason he's picking up the prostitute is he's taking her home so they can watch Three Stooges together.
That's it.
And by the way, Mel Gibson, huge Three Stooges fan. And of course, then that leads into the bursting into the office with the fish tank.
Meanie.
Love it.
Okay. So have you heard of the Mandela effect?
Yes.
I mean, we all have at this point, right?
Right.
You know why?
You told me about this.
You know why it's called the Mandela effect, though?
Because people misremember things about Nelson Mandela?
Yeah, like there is a significant contingent of the population that believe Nelson Mandela died in the 90s sometime.
Okay.
Right? And I mean, if you're unfamiliar with this, it's like a significant contingent of the population believes it's Berenstain Bears, which I believe until I read it to my kids. I'm like, why is it Berenstain Bears? Like something happened in the Matrix and they changed the letters. Dilemma has no N in it. A lot of people think dilemma has an N in it, dilemma, but it's not. It's never been that, but for some reason, a lot of us feel that way.
Okay.
Anyway, back to Mandela.
Yep.
Mandela, without getting too political on things, but he's a huge part of the apartheid issue in South Africa. He was imprisoned, ultimately released, ultimately became the president of South Africa after apartheid had ended. But they were already making movies about him in the 80s. As a matter of fact, there was a movie in 1987. It was just for HBO. It wasn't at the theaters. But a movie in 1987 called Mandela. You know who played Mandela?
Sidney Poitier. Danny Glover. Danny Glover. Dang it. You were setting me up for that, and I should have easily picked that up.
Yep.
Hey, there's a little nod to Lethal Weapon 2 and Lethal Weapon 4.
Okay.
It has to do with Chinese immigrants, and Murtaugh believes he's freeing slaves. But on the refrigerator, there's a sticker that says Stop Apartheid, which is a nod back, of course, to Lethal Weapon 2.
It's been on the refrigerator since Lethal Weapon 1. I noticed it whenever I saw, when we did our Lethal Weapon versus Die Hard episode, I noticed as I was watching a movie, the Stop Apartheid sticker was on the refrigerator in the very first movie.
Oh, yeah. That's cool. Okay, I want to talk to you about my least favorite scene in the movie. Actually, least favorite is kind of strong, but the scene that just doesn't seem real to me.
Okay.
Is when Riggs is going to go to the house on stilts, hook his truck up, and tear down the house on stilts.
It is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Like it's the truck is bouncing back and forth like it's on a Looney Tunes cartoon.
Right.
I mean, what an incredible flaw in architectural design to allow it to be able to be pulled down by a pickup truck.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it's a dually, but come on.
He's going to pull his axle out.
So that scene
cost
$100,000.
Really?
$500,000. I don't know that I would call it worth it. Like, I mean, it's impressive what happened, but it was like, is the payoff really that great?
Yeah.
I don't really think so.
Yeah. But I don't think so.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. It takes away the fact that the way that he's doing it, like if he had a winch and there was some sort of something that looked more than just like, I'm giving it all the gas I can give it, that would have been better. But
yeah,
it was a little absurd.
It was dumb. That actually is like the one thing that came over from the Shane Black script.
It is the only thing that came over, right?
Yep. Not a fan of that. Plus, Leo was inside.
Right? You know?
Leo was inside. Oh, come on.
Well, he gave Murtaugh the signal.
Watch for my signal. You know, we touched on it last episode. In fact, we talked about it pretty good. But the condom commercial at the beginning of the movie, it's one of those chemistry moments because Riggs is over. He's got his shoes off. He's sitting Indian style on their couch. And there's little subtle things like, Nick, get your feet off the table. And they're climbing over the stairs. Just everyday Americana stuff. And they're all excited to watch Rianne's debut on television. She's a budding actress. And you realize that it's a commercial for condoms.
Yeah.
And then for the rest of the movie, there's this, hey, that commercial is awesome. She makes me want to buy rubbers.
That line?
Yeah.
That's the carpenter, who they call McGee.
Yes.
The actor's name is actually Jack McGee.
Yeah.
And he improvised that line. He was like, well, what's wrong with the commercial? It makes me want to buy rubbers. It was, I mean, What a great moment for such a small part to be able to take it.
So funny. And then, of course, later the police guys bring a plant covered with condoms.
It's a condom Christmas tree. Because it's a rubber weapon tree. Is a Christmas movie.
Yes. Okay. One last scene I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Is Riggs's death / non-death at the end of Lethal Weapon 2.
Okay.
So, you know, Riggs is super pissed because now he's got Rika and Vicky that he's trying to avenge.
Not a cop tonight, Raj. This is personal.
Right. They get caught in that giant container. They blow the car out, and there's money everywhere. They set fire to the car. It's blowing up. Raj is even tempted to pocket some of the money because it's enough to put all of his kids through college. Riggs mm-hmm. tells him, hey, take it, man. Do it.
Yeah.
But they're running around. They're shooting up bad guys. And then Riggs gets a knife in the back, like in the hamstring.
Yeah.
That scene was intense because Riggs is wounded. Adolf comes out and starts kicking his butt a little bit. And then there's a fight over the knife.
The knife stays in his leg for most of the fight.
Yeah. Until he removes it to shove it in the guy's, you know, in his own chest. Much like the end of Gladiator. I don't know if you noticed that. Right. Very similar. But at that moment, you think, okay, Riggs kills Adolf. But then Erjan Rudd, out of nowhere, starts to shoot Riggs.
Right.
That was originally intended to be his death scene. They actually shot it both ways. Ultimately decided to have Riggs live. And I think that was a very, very good decision. You got two more movies out of it at least.
Well, let's talk about three. Lethal Weapon 5. It was going to happen. Like it was
Lethal Weapon 5?
It was in pre-production. Yeah. In pre-production until
Richard Donner died.
Until Richard Donner died. And if you go to the IMDb, it's back in development instead of in pre-production now. But per the wishes of Richard Donner, the director is now Mel Gibson.
Perfect. Perfect.
But who knows if we'll ever see it. I mean, Mel Gibson's over 65. Danny Glover's over 75. I mean, it's...
Danny Glover was too old for this back in 1987.
When he was 30.
Yeah. Right? Hey, you know, you talk about Mel Gibson being the director of Lethal Weapon 5, and I think that's the absolute right call, right?
Yeah.
This is the director of Braveheart and The Passion of the Christ and Apocalypto, all these super successful movies.
Hacksaw Ridge, yeah.
Hacksaw Ridge is one of my all-time favorite movies. But I sent you a video that you can find on YouTube where Mel Gibson has a camera and he's running around behind the scenes of Lethal Weapon 2.
You sent me this video. You texted me the video and I start watching it because it's called like the unauthorized diary of Mel Gibson, Lethal yes. Weapon 2, right? So I'm like, oh, this will be interesting. And I start watching it and about... halfway through the video, I texted you and I said, this is so dumb. Do I have to watch it all the way to the end? And you're like, no, you probably pretty well got it. I mean, it's like me and my high school friends with my camcorder when I was a kid. I mean, it's terrible.
It's terrible. It is,
I mean, I wasn't able to get cameos from Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd and Pee Wee Herman in my home video, but it's just stupid. Like they're all acting like high school kids who don't act would act. They're not even acting like actors. And so I'm watching this thinking, this guy directed Braveheart?
Yes.
Well, he learned a lot. That's from right. From 89 to 90, what was it, 93?
Braveheart was 95.
95.
Okay. Yeah. So he did learn a lot, apparently. Yes, if you feel so inclined, go check out that video on YouTube. It's horrible.
Okay. I think we got to move on to Last Crusade at this point.
Let's
right?
move on to Last Crusade.
All right.
Junior? Yes, sir. It is you, Junior. Don't call me that, please.
Okay, we talked pretty extensively last time about the very beginning, the young indie scenes with River Phoenix, where you've got the Cross Coronado, grabs the bullwhip for the first time, he gets the scar on his chin.
Mm-hmm. It's a big day.
Right. You have him not scared of snakes until he falls in this giant container full of snakes.
Yep.
He gets the hat from the guy they call Fedora, who was originally supposed to be Abner Ravenwood, and then the Cross of Coronado. And then, of course, you flash forward, and you've got Indiana Jones on a ship battling for the Cross of Coronado to get that. It belongs in a museum.
So do you.
Right. And then they're like, kill him, you know, throw him over the side.
It's ridiculous. The boat scene's ridiculous. And, like, how does he live? How does he get through that? And how did the... cross not sink to the bottom of the ocean instantaneously.
I know, right. First of all, they're going to kill him by throwing him over the side. He's like, nope, I'm going to beat a couple of guys up, then I'm going to jump over the side. Take that, bad guys.
Well, he realizes the boat's about to explode, right?
Well, that was dumb. It's fun, but it's dumb.
They bring that scene right back to us in The Adventures of Tintin. in the 21st century.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, right.
Same thing. It ends in the boat exploding and them gathering just a bit of the treasure as they're floating along.
Also, I want to talk about the scene at the library.
Okay.
Where they've got Dad's diary,
mm-hmm.
and they've got the Roman numerals, and he's pointing, look at that, 6, 9, where's 10? Everywhere, where's 10? Looking for 10. That scene was really cool, but they're standing on a tile that's like 10 foot by 10 foot. It's not like it's the biggest X in the world. You can just look down and go, oh, that's 10 right there. That's an X.
Yeah.
But you have
that. Where's the X? Where is it?
It's eluding us, right? But they end up in the catacombs. And you have, like the snakes in part one,
uh-huh.
like the bugs in part two, you have this big scene with rats.
Rats. Yeah.
What'd you think of that scene?
I thought it was a nice throwback. You know, like Indy's afraid of snakes. His dad's afraid of rats. Had rats. Yeah.
Right.
Lots of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was a good throwback, yeah.
They used a lot of real rats, but because they didn't want to transfer any disease, they had to grow their own rats.
Okay.
So they had like 2,000 rats that had never been in touch with any other rats in the entire world ever, ever, ever.
Uh-huh.
And so they're essentially clean rats.
Okay. So this brings me to an interesting point. Now, we've talked about the composers in both of these movies plenty of times before.
Yes.
We've got John Williams with Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. We've got Mark Kamen with Lethal Weapon, who he's done a million things too, right? John Williams still with us today, still making music.
Still kicking.
Mark Kamen passed away in 2003. But what we haven't talked about, and this I feel is important in this one, is the other aspect of sound. It's the sound editing and sound design of the movie itself. And a throwback to a Patreon episode, you know who the sound designer was for Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade and Temple of Doom and Raiders of the Lost Ark is, right?
Is it Ben Burtt?
You got it. It's yes. Ben Burtt.
I mean, Ben Burtt's the guy who created the sound for the guns in Star Wars and the lightsabers.
Yeah, I mean, another part of that deal was the sound of the guns. I mean, if you listen to the sound of the guns in Raiders and all of the rest of the movies, it's not a small sound.
Yeah.
Well, that's because they're using a 30-30 to make the sound.
That's true.
They're to make the sound of a handgun, of a pistol, right? But it's big and powerful. It's like the hit. And that one, I think they were slapping a mattress or a leather coat
with a baseball bat.
Yeah, slapping leather coats with a baseball bat is how we get the punch sound.
Great.
So back to the rats.
Yes.
Do you know what the sound of the rats is?
No, I don't have no idea.
Chickens.
What? It's
chickens. Like they couldn't figure out any rat sounds, right? Like they couldn't get any good rat sounds because rats really don't make that much noise.
Right.
It's pretty small. But chickens make a lot of noise. If you've ever been in a chicken pen, yeah. They make a lot of noise, but they don't sound like rats.
Okay.
Unless you speed them up. And then that was the sound of the rats, which you've got, of course, also the sound of the flame. Remember that the Knights Templar guys start the fire and then all the rats are burning. By the way, none of the rats in the burn scene were actual real rats. Those were robot
mechanical,
and plastic. Yeah, not real rats. But anyway, but you have that awesome sound effect of all of the rats freaking the frick out because there's a giant ball of fire consuming everything in sight.
I'm going to talk about something awesome before I talk about something that was kind of dumb.
Okay. Yep.
So Indiana Jones is going through the catacombs. He's got Dr. Elsa Schneider with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he rubs his hand on the wall and you see the Ark of the Covenant.
I mean, it's such a basic, like, it's basic, like, grade school drawing. Like, if I was going to draw the Ark of the Covenant in third grade, that's what it would have looked like.
Yeah, with a crayon, you know. Just, yeah,
exactly.
But you get the John Williams, you get the musical score, the theme for the Ark.
Huh?
And she's like, what's that? And he's like, it's the Ark of the Covenant. She's like, are you sure? He's like, pretty sure. Which is a great throwback to Raiders.
It is, yeah. And he throws it away. He totally throws I love that he throws it away. It makes it even better.
Yeah.
You sure? Pretty sure.
Then you end up with, you know, the knights trying to kill him by dropping a match in the petroleum and in the river. Which,
I mean, by the way, he lights a torch himself. And I'm watching the fire dripping
fire
off of that torch the entire time. How did that not? If one match can start that whole thing ablaze like Jerry Lee Lewis, what?
Yeah.
She had real rats in her hair, by the way. Those were real. Oh, yeah. Those were not mechanical rats. She had the real rats in her hair. So good for her for toughing through that. And then when they come out there in the bistro, like the
right
outside eating area of some cafe in Italy.
Yeah. They just pop out. They're at a coffee shop. But here's the thing. So those knights are trying to kill him. They've tried to burn him to death. You know, they jump on the boat and they're attacking them. They try to shoot him. They try to squeeze him between boats. They're trying to get him chopped up in a giant propeller. And he's like, tell me, where's my father? Blah, blah, blah. And then he's like, I don't even care about the Grail. I'm just looking for my dad. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, well, in that case, God be with you. All that, I was like, this is great action, but that didn't make a lot of sense to me in the movie.
Agreed.
But I'm willing to look over it because the action piece is so great.
Okay. So as long as we're talking about things that don't work, like I can live with a lot of that stuff, right?
Right.
What's troubling for me is really a very big aspect of the movie itself. And that is that the Knights Templar, we know the story is three knights wandered into the wilderness. 150 years later, one of them comes out, looks very old and dies on the spot, right? But before he dies, passes this information, right?
Right.
And then we get the end of the movie where what we have to say is the third knight is still there protecting the Grail, right?
Right.
Well, they had the Grail when they went into the wilderness.
Okay.
And then they got to this big cave. It's a real place, by the way.
Yeah, Petra, yeah.
Yeah.
Tristan Martin's been there, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I haven't been there, but I mean, I was shocked to find out that this was not a Hollywood thing. That Petra is a real thing carved into the rock like that.
I think it's in Jordan. Okay.
And so how is it that they get it into this spot that then after it's taken away from the spot, it causes an earthquake? Like, how does that make any sense? Like, what's going on here that, if it's that magical, why did we need a painted rock bridge? I mean, it should have been really by faith. He was really walking on air. I mean, we didn't need the slicer dicer head chopper thing. It was all magical. So you just go with magical. So why is this cup, if you crossed the seal, that obviously the knights put there? I mean, the Grail didn't start there.
Right.
Why does it cause the earthquake whenever it crosses the seal?
The answer to that question is, I have no idea. But I will just tell you, you've got to believe, boy.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this.
Yeah.
Throwback to Ben Bird again.
Yes.
Earthquake, rubbing on a balloon, combined with rolling rocks down a hill on Skywalker Ranch.
Okay. Sounds good. Another great scene from Indiana Jones Part 3.
Yeah. So tank scene. Yeah, that was a George Lucas. Like, he wants to have a tank in this chase scene.
Yeah.
And it works well. Like, it's a fun, scary moment. Yeah. Now, I still said, why are we taking a tank to an archaeological dig? Is that necessary?
We don't care.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Inside Petra.
Alexandretta tomb.
Alexandretta.
Yeah.
You have the three, you have, like, the penitent man will pass test.
Uh-huh, yep.
Because a man kneels before God. Kneels! Then you have the footsteps of God.
But in the Latin alphabet, Jehovah starts with an I.
Yeah. And then you have the bridge of faith. I thought all those were great.
Yeah. Yeah. Historically interesting ideas that biblically relate to some things. Penitent man being one, Jehovah the name being the other, and then an act of faith. Yeah. No, I thought that Boehm did a great job pulling those things out and making them like the Arthurian hero's quests.
Yeah. But, you know, during that scene, you've also got the fact that his dad has been shot.
Uh-huh.
And Marcus keeps yelling at him, Indy, hurry. Please hurry. So you've got all these challenges, but he doesn't have any time to spare.
Right.
So.
Puts the time pressure on. Got that clock ticking.
It's fun. It's fun.
It's good writing. Good writing right there.
We talked about how choosing the cup of Christ once he gets through there, Donovan chooses the wrong one.
He chose poorly.
He just arbitrarily, she's like, this one. He's like, yep,
looks great. She's freaking knows what she is doing. She knows exactly what she's doing.
It's this one.
He drinks the cup, right? So we see him front view, drink the cup, and the bottom of the cup is hollow with a little silver. Like, I'm like, is that a bolt? Did that? What is that? Why would they show us that? That's not the way an old cup from that time would have looked. They wouldn't have made it like that, but that's what they did, right?
Yeah.
Obviously a very poor choice.
Yes. And then he goes through this aging process. It's kind of it's the big scary effect of this movie.
It's the opening of the arc scene. Yeah, for sure. Like I told you, man, it's very beat for beat the same movie.
Yeah. Indy makes the the wise choice by selecting a wooden cup. And then, like we said before, he's got to carry it back to save his dad who has been shot.
Right.
But you can't take it past the seal. What good is this thing?
Right.
I mean, come on. You have this big earthquake. When Elsa tries to take it, she's like, we got it. Let's go. Giant earthquake. Now, Elsa falls off. Andy grabs her and is trying to save her. She's trying to still reach the grail.
Yeah.
And he's like, Elsa, give me your other hand. I can't hold you. And she's trying to grab the grail. Well, she falls into nothingness. The same place that the girl in Superman 2.
Superman 2, yeah. You know what? You're a pain in the neck.
Then Andy falls off the edge. Henry Jones Sr. grabs his hand. Andy's trying to grab the grail. Mm-hmm. This is the great part of this scene. He says, Indiana, let it go. And it's him calling him by his preferred name.
Right.
That causes him to sort of come to his senses and pull himself out.
Right. By the way, this Junior, what does this mean? We named the dog Indiana. So everybody knows that Indiana comes from George Lucas's dog.
Yes.
That was named Indiana.
Yes.
That was a Malamute.
Yes.
You see him in the first, the River Phoenix comes into the house, comes in, and he walks in the door, and the dog looks up at him, and it is that Malamute.
Wow.
Okay, so here's an interesting fact about Sean Connery.
Yes.
He has a sweating problem.
Yes.
And so they're filming the scene in the Zeppelin.
Yep.
And you look at it, think about all the people, all the women dressed in furs and hats and long dresses, and all the men are dressed in full three-piece suits, right? Everybody's well, it was summertime. It was hot.
Yep.
And Sean Connery says, we're about to have this scene where they're sitting at the table talking about the different quests.
You left right when you were getting interested.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you want to talk about? I'm here. Let's talk. I don't know what to say. Well, all right. There's work to do.
Right.
So that scene, Sean Connery is like, guys, I'm taking off my pants. And they're like, what? No, sir. And he's like, guys, I have a sweating problem and it's hot. And so if you want this scene to play right, I mean, if it's supposed to be winter, I'm not going to be dripping sweat and wet in my clothes. So I got to lose the pants. And Harrison Ford's like, are you really going to take off your pants? He says, yeah, I am. He goes, and I'm going to take off my pants too. And so both Harrison Ford and Sean Connery are pantless during that scene.
That's fantastic.
Okay. In this movie, we get more of a payoff of what we got teased with in Raiders of the Lost Ark with the Nazis.
Okay.
Like he's, you know, your boss, Der Führer, you know, they have a few German soldiers, but in this movie, we go to Berlin and we don't just see Hitler. We see all of the Nazis.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, all of those costumes were actual German soldier costumes. Like they found a, you know, some closet full of German costumes or uniforms, and they used those for the costumes in this scene, right? The book burning scene, if you're forgetting what I'm talking about here. So you've got Hitler, you've got the book burning scene, and all of those guys are doing the Heil Hitler. Now, in the 1980s, this is not too distant a future. So people were still like, ugh, when they see these guys doing the Heil Hitler thing, right?
Sure. 40 years.
Nazis. I hate these guys.
Yeah.
I think that was totally out of Blues Brothers, by the way.
Okay.
I really do believe that was taken from Blues Brothers. But anyway, so Steven Spielberg is directing all of this. A guy who's Jewish. Like he's got, like this is a more meaningful thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy goes on to direct Schindler's List, right?
Yeah.
So in all of the scenes where the guys are doing the Zeke Heil hand salute, he said, okay, guys, I want you to put your other hand behind your back and cross your fingers.
Funny. Hey, you know, you and I talked about, I remember watching this in the movie theater.
Yeah.
When Indiana Jones has the grail, he's gone to the belly of the beast to retrieve the Holy Grail diary. And he takes it from Elsa. He gets kind of pushed in this direction, that direction, and he ends up face-to-face with Adolf Hitler.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when we're in the theater, we're like, what is this? What is going to happen here? Hitler pulls out the book and then autographs it and gives it back to him. So the Holy Grail Diary has Adolf Hitler's autograph. Crazy.
Yeah, it's great.
All right, D, are we ready for final judgment?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Is your soul prepared?
My soul is prepared. How's yours? But here's a question that you posed that we haven't discussed yet. Who is more important to the franchise, This is a big question for you.
Yeah.
We get the introduction of Henry Jones Sr.,
yep.
Sean Connery.
Yep.
And we get the introduction of Leo Getz.
Can I give you two guys a friendly piece of advice, okay? Don't ever go up to the drive-thru, okay? Always walk up to the counter. You know why? Okay. They f*** you at the drive-thru, okay? They f*** you at the drive-thru.
Who then goes on to do the next two movies with them. Right?
Yeah, he does.
And so your question to me was, which of these two is the more important character, right?
That's right.
For the franchise.
Yes.
It's a hard question. Obviously, with Leo Getz, you get further characters from movie to movie. But Leo Getz does not provide you with an insight into the soul and origin of Martin Riggs or Murtaugh.
Right.
He doesn't. He's comic relief. He's an antagonist for them to play against. And he's great.
Yes.
I love him. He's great.
Right, right.
But he's not something that adds meaning to the story. Adding a Henry Jones Sr. to take a character that we already loved because he was a multi-level character, right? Like an imperfect hero, the anti-hero. To take him and go, oh, now I'm beginning to understand why he is the way he is. And then also putting him in those situations where, you know, even a prophet is not respected in his own country. Like, like when he's around his dad, he's still a little kid again, which is crazy because we've seen this guy. We've wanted to be this guy. And now we're like, he's just a goofball guy who just wants his dad to love him.
Right.
Yeah. So it's got to be Henry Jones Sr. for me. It's got to be Sean Connery.
Okay. I think this is a great question because of those reasons that you mentioned.
Yeah.
One adds levels to a character that we know and love. The other adds laughs. So I'm taking Leo Getz because he leveled up the franchise and because he stuck around for another two movies after that.
Right.
So I'm going quantity, you're going quality.
Right. Well, you can't really blame Sean Connery for not wanting to hang around for the next movie after.
I can't.
Whose name shall not be spoken on this podcast.
That's right. That final shot of The Last Crusade as they
ride off into the sunset.
Yes. Which was added at the last second, by the way.
Yeah.
Shot in Amarillo, Texas. Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Okay. So since you said that, I had this trivia bit, but I didn't think it was interesting enough.
Yeah.
Petra, we said in Jordan, when they're on the horses outside of the Petra,
yeah.
They're having the conversation about what Junior means, right?
Yes.
Those four horses were owned by the king of Jordan, King Hussein.
Wow.
He let them borrow his horses to film that scene.
That's great. All right, here we are. D, final judgment between these two amazing sequels of the summer of 1989.
You go first.
Oh, okay. So let me just say right off the bat, Raiders of the Lost Ark is my all-time favorite movie. Temple of Doom was fun for me in parts, and I am a defender of Temple of Doom, but its tone, the darkness of it, kind of let me down a little bit. Willie Scott drives me insane the whole time. So I was really, really pleased with where part three went. I think the addition of Sean Connery's character was a big level up, and it pushes it almost to Raiders level, right? If Raiders is a 10 out of 10 for me, Last Crusade's probably a 9 out of 10. I mean, it's so good, so fun. It's very enjoyable. It does have its faults that are a little bit unrealistic in some spots, but it's so much fun that I just love it. Lethal Weapon 2 was a sequel to a movie that I loved as well, but it improved on the franchise so much by adding the chemistry that we already love. You add Leo Getz, you add humor. The chemistry has grown. The characters have grown. The action is off the charts. I absolutely love Lethal Weapon 2. I'm casting my vote. I am going to say that I enjoy Lethal Weapon 2 just a tad more than Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. So mark me down, Lethal Weapon 2.
Okay. So we've talked before, and I've said before, I think that maybe Last Crusade is better than Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's for blasphemy.
Okay. That might have been deserved, right?
Okay.
So in rewatching it again, I watched this movie several times with the kids, Last Crusade. Yeah. I watched it more than I watched Raiders with them because you didn't have melting faces in this one, right?
Right.
You got one scene where the head goes rolling down like a bowling ball, but you know, that was enough. That's fine.
Right.
But in rewatching it, I did see more of the problems than I had kind of noticed before. I felt like the religious imagery in this one was stronger than it was in Raiders, which was impressive to me because it was really strong in Raiders.
Right.
At this point, I don't know that I would say that it's better than Raiders, but they are so dang close. Like, I mean, you're saying a 10 and a 9, and I'm saying a 9.7 and a 9.5.
Okay.
You know, like, they're super close.
Okay.
Especially because of Sean Connery, right? Now, the question is not whether it's better than Raiders or not. It's whether it's better than Lethal Weapon
2. That's right.
Or not. And again, in Lethal Weapon 2, you find out some history, right? You find out what happened to Vicky Riggs. Just like both movies, we've got some expositional history that like gives these characters more flesh, more reality. But at the end of the day, they're both so good that it honestly, it comes down to, do I want to watch a cop movie or do I want to watch an action adventure movie? And almost always the answer to that question for me is going to be an action adventure movie. The fantasy level, even though it's reality, the fantasy level of the supernatural, the religious aspect, the beautiful retelling of, I mean, it's a perfect sequel. It is really just taking it and mixing it up and telling it to us in a different way.
Sure.
Is done so well. I got to pick Last Crusade.
Love it. I love it. I don't blame you at all.
Yeah.
I love both. That's fantastic. Well, we want to hear from you guys. How did we do? Where are you on this argument? Where do you stand with which is the best sequel?
By the way, just to add on to that, I was confident when I started this process that I was going to pick Last Crusade. I knew I was.
Yeah.
But I was shocked at how much I liked Lethal Weapon 2 because I didn't remember it being as good as it was. And it is fantastic. It was a much closer race by the time they finished than I thought it was going to be. These are two incredible movies. And if you haven't seen them in a while, go back and watch them again. Watch them with your kids. Watch them with your family. And tell us, who got it right? Did Jason get it right? Lethal Weapon 2? Or did I get it right? Last Crusade.
Might want to fast forward past Patsy Kinsett's boobs if you're watching with your kids.
Yeah.
All right. What do we have next week?
Next week. Well, it's Rush Week.
It is.
It's Rush Week. You know what that means. Time for some hazing. Time for some drinking and sexcapades. It's time to go back to school.
Back to college.
Yep.
We are comparing Revenge of the Nerds from 1984 versus Animal House 1988.
My gosh, that means that those movies are 40 and 46 years old. Yeah. I wonder how much different college is now than it was 40 and 46 years ago.
Come back next week and we'll find out.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you so much. Guys, hope you like the song we had last week. Sounds like an 80s man to me. The Shirley You Can't Be Serious Band is back again, and they have a Shirley theme song for us. Guys, here it is. Surely You Can't Be Serious.
When I was a little boy, the movies brought me so much joy, and the music kicked butt like nothing today. Then the world went insane, but that's when Shirley came and gave me joy in that same old way. Surely there's a time machine. Surely we won't cross the streams. Surely this can't be the best there is. Surely you're my rocket queen. Got my back against the wrecking machine. Surely you can't be serious. Jason, Michael, scarier. Dogs and cats, mass hysteria. Feels like the dark side of the wall. Shirley kept her motor clean. Yeah, she is a killer queen. But
like the football.
Surely there's a time machine. Surely we won't cross the streams. Surely this can't be the best there is. Surely you're my rocket queen. Got my back against the wrecking machine. Surely you can't be serious. Gina, they both knew. Bill and Ted, they knew it too. Shirley's raw and delirious. Daniel Crane kicked Johnny's face. We're all digging in the wrong place. Surely you can't be serious. Han shot first. Rocky became a trucker. Han's booby was the worst. Yippee-ki-yay, I am serious. And don't call me Shirley. Surely you can't be. Surely you can't be. Surely you can't be serious. Surely you can't be. Surely you can't be. Surely you can't be serious.